What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like who is actually stepping in to save people from sorcery accusation violence in Papua New Guinea?
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group there, and then they accused her, like, you must be the sorceress.
To listen, search Politalk in your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll take a look at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, more Nako subs are washing ashore in the Pacific. Seven have been discovered in just the past year and a half. Australia's foreign minister caught in the middle of a verbal scrum over Samoa rugby funding. And concerns over Pacific workers living in dilapidated housing in Australia. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, two more Nako subs, semi-submersible vehicles used for smuggling drugs across international waters, have been discovered in the Pacific. That means seven of the low-profile, high-speed boats have now been found in regional waters in the past 18 months. The discoveries have worried experts, and as Lucy Cooper reports, it's prompted Australia to step up support in the region.
On the idyllic beaches of the Marshall Islands, narco boats are washing ashore. Arkman Laukuan, a local of Anu Atoll, where two subs were recently discovered, said he was concerned.
I would encourage or plead to the government or any of the Pacific Islands to kind of give an eye on these kind of things that are coming, these kind of activities that happening around the island.
Since the start of the year, record drug seizures and narco sub-discoveries have dominated headlines in the Pacific region. Professor Alexander Gillespie of the University of Waikato said it's extraordinary.
You're seeing busts now which are just going through the roof. I mean, just insane amounts of drug.
An expert in international law, he warns the situation will only worsen as organised crime groups chase growing drug markets in Australia and New Zealand.
This is going to get worse. The corruption will get more, and the crime and the death and the mayhem and the negative impacts will all just accelerate.
The increasing use of the Pacific as a major drug corridor is placing a strain on resources. In the Solomon Islands, four narco subs have been discovered, but only two have been investigated by local authorities.
We don't have funds available to respond on time.
That's Patricia Letter, the Solomon Islands Assistant Commissioner for Crime and Intelligence. Professor Alexander Gillespie said it's up to Australia and New Zealand to boost local crime-fighting resources.
You've got to put more money and resources into the Pacific than we've done in the past. And that's happening at a time when America is walking away from the Pacific and putting in less resources into it when we need to be putting more.
In 2024, Australia announced it would provide $400 million over 5 years to the Pacific Policing Initiative, which aims to establish regional training centres, a Pacific Police support group, and a development and coordination hub. The Australian Federal Police has over 100 members located across the Pacific. For Solomon Islands opposition leader Matthew Wale, he'd like to see Trump tactics adopted.
I like what Trump is doing, you know, shooting these boats out of the water and killing them all to smithereens.
Professor Gillespie said whilst the idea was popular, it was far from effective.
There is an appetite in the world right now, in the populist world, for vengeance. And people want to just do this kind of knee-jerk reaction whereby they kill people. The problem is it violates the most fundamental principles of human rights law and basic criminal law and basic civil liberties, that everyone has a right to a trial and that they must be proven guilty. I very much doubt that Trump's actions have made a dent in the illegal drug trade.
Back in the Marshall Islands, Arkman Laukuan says more subs in the region mean more drugs.
We are having problems here, our youths, and we see people are taking drugs here and there. I think the main cause of the drugs being on the island is through this kind of stuff that wash ashore. I mean, end up on our reefs or beaches.
Marshall Islands resident Athman Laukon ending that report from Lucy Cooper. Samoa's government has banned a senior journalist from future press conferences following a heated exchange with the Prime Minister over funding for Pacific Rugby. The incident in question was a joint press conference with Samoa's Prime Minister and the visiting Australian Foreign Minister, Penny Wong. As the ABC's reporter in Samoa reports, the government has issued a letter to the Journalists Association raising concerns over the journalist's conduct, attire and his tone of questioning.
By cultural standards, Samoa's Prime Minister deemed the exchange between a local reporter disrespectful.
There was certain haste regarding Samoa. He's being held up by the Prime Minister. And the reason that he's in Sweden, or he was in Sweden, is because there are questionable issues inside the rugby union that involves the chairman, who also happens to be the leader of the opposition. But the leader of the opposition is playing, the Prime Minister is playing politics with your money.
Mataitlinga Bill Seor from Newsline Samoa wanted to know what Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong thought of the situation.
Were you aware that by giving the money to the government, you expose your aid, your politics, internal politics or commission politics of a country?
But Ms. Wong, a seasoned politician used to performing on the international stage, wasn't going to be drawn in.
Well, first I'd say, as a guest in your country, I'm not going to get involved in your domestic politics.
The reporter responded by saying, you're copping out.
No, I'm going to respond to the things that I think are important for me to respond to as Australia's Foreign Minister. The second point I would make to you is that we are awaiting a collective application for more rugby union funding from not just Samoa, but from, I think it's Tonga and, is it Fiji? I think, yes, Fiji, which I've already spoken to Prime Minister Rambuka about. And when we receive that, we will look at that.
But the repeated interruptions and its tone appeared to upset Prime Minister Lauriel Malietopulatoevo Fosse Schmidt, whose jovial demeanour turned stone-faced. He's the reason a $150 million Australian funding package for Pacific Rugby Development is being held up. Announced last year, the money is to be divided between Fiji, Tonga and Samoa, but the Prime Minister is yet to give his approval. That's because his longtime rival, current opposition leader and former Prime Minister, Sulaepa Dr. Seilele Malilengoi, is the chairman of the Lakapi Samoa board, and Lauriel Malietoa wants him gone. At the press conference, he told Ms. Wong rugby in Samoa had become politicised and it needed to be cleaned up.
Rugby is a game that we really important to us, but somehow it's been politicised. And that is where we're coming in to clear out all the politicians inside our rugby union, first and foremost. We want the rugby to leave to the hands of the players and the people that loves the rugby the most. At this stage, our rugby is very in poor condition. We are in the level that Samoa never been before. Because of what? Because of management. So your assistance is much appreciated to develop our rugby again. So leave it to us. I will make sure I'll sign if everything is sorted out from here. So in a way, no more politics inside rugby.
That didn't satisfy Mr. Seor, though. And as he tried to ask follow-up questions, things got tense. He was approached by a police officer. They argued and the reporter was forced to leave. But before exiting, he slammed a chair loudly while the press conference continued. It's not the first time a reporter has been told to leave a government press conference. The Prime Minister has banned all reporters and photographers from the Samoa Observer newspaper from attending government press conferences and events. That remained the case during Foreign Minister Wong's visit. At the end of the press conference, Lauli tried to change the tone.
I apologize. I apologize, Honourable Minister, for the media personnel here. You see now important of a rugby here. Everybody's arguing about the rugby, but we'll sort it out and we'll advise you.
As the politicians got up to leave, he let loose a final barb. In Samoan, he said, "Tell that guy to go shower. Comb his hair. He's too noisy."
The ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin, with that report. A provincial government in New Caledonia has announced it will resume culling sharks after a man died in an attack. The 55-year-old windsurfer was found dead near the popular beach of Ansewata in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea. The decision to resume culling has prompted concerns from environmental groups, who say the decision is legally indefensible and politically irresponsible, as a New Caledonian court banned shark culls in 2024. Professor Eric Kluwer is an expert in shark behavior, and he says indiscriminate shark culling is an ineffective and unscientific strategy for preventing shark attacks.
I think that it will not be effective as for the past, you know, culling campaigns, blind culling campaigns were never really effective, you know, to solve the problem of shark attacks. So I'm very actually frustrated, you know, because I know very well the place. And I think that New Caledonia is not doing not implementing the right strategy, you know, to face the problem they have. Of course, shark attacks, you know, they are tragedy, but what they are doing, actually, I would say it's useless. It's useless and won't be at all effective. Actually, you know, the shark culling was banned, you know, after a legal decision, you know, but actually, you know, the political people, you know, they just put that back on the table because it seemed that they don't know anything else than you know, killing sharks when there is such a tragedy, which is a pity, actually.
The provincial government, they're saying they're going to use drumline measures and they'll target sharks as well. What does the science tell us about culling and these methods that the government is employing?
What the science is telling us now, and I have proven it myself, you know, with an example, you know, in the Caribbean where we have been proving what I was saying, which is about having very few sharks capable, you know, to feed on humans. So we call that problem sharks. So if you cull sharks blindly, you will just kill animals that will never have any negative interaction with people. So of course it's a nonsense. I mean, to kill blindly these sharks. What you should do is put in place a different strategy that will allow you, you know, to find these offenders, I would say, because actually there is few attacks, although they are a tragedy, of course, but there is not that many attacks. And most of the time, I would say they are repeat offenses. You know what I mean? So we should look specifically, surgically, I would say, you know, for these problem individuals. For doing that, it's possible. I mean, a new strategy is possible. It would mean that we should look for the DNA, for the fingerprint, doing fingerprinting. We should look for the DNA of the shark that has just bitten, you know, on the human wounds, something that we don't usually do, but we should do that to have the profile of the offender. We wouldn't kill them. We just get, you know, some DNA from the shark. And we could tag the shark. Once you do that, you can, of course, like people that will be dealing, you know, with terrorism, you know, you have your database of reference and you know your potential offenders. And when it happens, then you can identify, you know, the offender. And then you look specifically, you know, for that shark and you remove it. You remove it without culling, you know, all the other sharks.
When the provincial government carried out culling in 2023, there's reports that about 127 sharks were killed in this process. There was a court order that stopped the culling. Now the provincial government has gone against this and it has resumed culling. Are you concerned that the government is acting against a court decision?
Yes, of course. To tell you the truth, I don't even know how they can do that because there is, you know, an NGO that provoked, you know, that decision of the court, and they tried first, and they gained, you know, the banning of the culling campaign. Then the government tried again, you know, a second time in what we call an appeal, and they lost. So they lost twice, you know. So I don't know how, actually, from a legal point of view, they are daring, you know, to do that again. time, you know, they are changing. I think that people are less and less ready, you know, to accept that you would kill, you know, blindly animals because they kill a man. Of course, it's a tragedy again. If we were doing the same with people, just imagine you have a serial killer in Sydney or Melbourne, you know, and you send the police in the street and you tell them, okay, every Homo sapiens, every human you see, you just kill it. You know what I mean? And like that, we will solve the problem of the serial killer. Of course, people will understand that you will never solve the problem, you know, that way. And unfortunately, that is what we are doing with sharks.
Is there anything the government, the provincial government, can do in the next week or so to deal with this issue?
Well, if they dare or if they want, they can call me and I would be pleased, you know, to support them from a technical and scientific point of view, you know, to implement a more clever, you know, strategy that will, which is not about not killing sharks. But again, I am not about against killing sharks. But what I'm proposing is being as efficient as possible by targeting, you know, the offender and avoid that offender to repeat, you know, any other, you know, attack. I don't know. I'm not hoping that there will be another attack, but actually, I will bet, you know, that it might be the same shark that will attack again if there is another, you know, another attack. And that's why we should target specifically these individuals.
And that was Professor Eric Kluwer, a shark expert, speaking from French Polynesia there. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, and in this show, we are reviewing the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. An inspection in regional Victoria has uncovered substandard and overcrowded accommodation for workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. The scheme brings people from the Pacific and Timor-Leste to fill labour shortages in Australia, and regulators say the mistreatment of temporary migrant workers is a national problem. The ABC's Lily Cristano with this report.
When inspectors came to look at a home in Warragul in Victoria's east, they were confronted with sewage pooling in the front yard. Inspectors from Victoria's Labour Hire Authority had received a tip that migrant workers were being housed in substandard conditions. As they made their way inside, they found extensive black mould covering doors, windows, ceilings and curtains. They found 22 migrant workers housed in unsanitary conditions in a single home and a granny flat. The authority's licensing commissioner, Steve Dargavel, said the property, about 2 hours east of Melbourne, was riddled with inadequate facilities.
There were issues with payments, outrageous deductions for the accommodation, terrible overcrowding, workers being charged $190 each for sharing part of a floor in a room. Some of the premises had dozens of workers in them. Black mould, no washing machine, dozens of people sharing a single four-plate hot burner for a stove. So not great conditions.
Mr. Dargavel says substandard accommodation for horticultural workers is a national problem.
Unfortunately, far too often, workers in the horticultural industry are mistreated, underpaid, and subject to abuse, occasionally violence. And in this case, really terrible and unsafe accommodation and overcharging.
The authority, which works to prevent the exploitation of labour hire workers, also found workers from the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, or PALM scheme, were being housed in a motel. One of these workers, who wished to remain anonymous, told the ABC 31 people lived at the motel, with only one kitchen and one washing machine shared among the workers. She said there were 5 people in one room and she had no sense of privacy when talking to her family members overseas. The Labour Hire Authority found indications of controls placed on the workers' use of showers, washing machines and heating and cooling. Laurie Berg from the Migrant Justice Institute says this can be used as a control mechanism on the workers.
I think that a coercive relationship between the employer and the worker under the scheme is a real issue.
Under the PALM scheme, workers are tied to their approved employer as a condition of their visa. Ms. Berg says PALM scheme workers are often hesitant to speak up because they're scared of repercussions from their employer.
They feared that if they aired their concerns that they might lose their job, Others said that they feared causing problems for their co-workers or that their employer might give them less work or no work if they raised a concern.
Ms Berg wants the government to explore forms of supported mobility in the scheme so workers have a way to change their employer.
Unless workers have the possibility to change employers when things go wrong, they just won't speak up.
The labour hire company that housed the workers in those properties, Kaishan Propriety Limited, which operates as top-of-the-crop labour hire, says it has strengthened its accommodation verification and oversight processes. The Labour Hire Authority's Licensing Commissioner, Steve Dugavel, says since the inspection, the workers have been moved to safer, hygienic accommodation and have stopped having to pay deductions from their wages.
I spoke to a lot of workers affected by this personally. Lovely people, hardworking, honest, just fantastic people that any employer would be very lucky to have. So it was very sad to see how poorly mistreated they were.
And that was Victoria's Labour Hire Licensing Commissioner, Steve Dugavel, ending that report from Lily Cristanto. Australians are drinking more kava than ever, with over 50 tonnes imported from the Pacific in the past year. Fiji is the largest supplier, but Vanuatu is catching up fast, pushing past Tonga as the second largest exporter of kava in the region. The ABC's Leo Lawanbu reports on how that demand is reshaping life for Vanuatu's kava producers and exporters.
Back in Vanuatu, kava is a way of life and a business with a high customer demand. But for kava seller Alfred Kwai in Brisbane, it's a different story.
It's obviously far north and in Victoria.
I know that in far north Queensland and Victoria, where there are large Pacific populations, they sell kava every day. But here in Brisbane, it's a steady growth, just a thing during the weekend. But during the week, there's pretty much nothing happening.
Business might be slow for Mr. Kwai, but kava's popularity is surging in Australia. Pacific Trade Infest says more than 50 tonnes of kava has been imported over the past 4 years. Fiji is the biggest source supplier, and last year alone Vanuatu overtook Tonga as second biggest exporter of kava. Despite the growth, the founder of Vanuatu Noble Kava, Francois Chani, says challenges still remain.
I have a very positive outlook on the product as long as we keep supplying a good quality kava. Marketing, it's very expensive, but it is very important. It is very important we are there telling them what is the product, what is the benefit of the product. Then people try it and some people come back with some good comment and some people come back with some not so good comment. But that's what it is.
Turning kava into a tea, an instant kava, is something Mr. Chani is trying out to attract new customers.
It's one of the best sellers for us here because in Australia, people are so busy. It's fast-paced, unlike Vanuatu, where people can spend time squeezing the kava. So it's these kind of value-added products that we need to think about, and there's so much more to do.
More and more Vanuatu kava is making its way into the Australian market. But industry operators say there's a heavy of paperwork to be overcome first, from import certificates to regulations. Pacific Santo Limited Kava Director Alex Adams says it's not easy task sending kava to Australia.
It's not really good for us in terms of investment. If I plan to do an investment for importing into Australia, I have to be secured that the market won't be closing after the program Australia have opened. The second thing I would say in terms of the regulations, that's harder than in other countries. That's not bad as well because that's the beginning of the market. So you guys have a lot of kava coming in, not always the best one. So that control is good. And the last thing I would say that the main part is there is too many competition, putting a lot of money in marketing because we have to compete with 100 brands instead of when the market would have done itself the selection. It would be like maybe 20 brands or 10 brands. So now we can go inside and it will be way more easier for the visibility.
The Australian thirst for kava is also putting pressure on Vanuatu farmers. Mr. Adam, who is based on the island of Santo, says growers must prepare for changing market dynamics.
The volume is impressive compared to before. That's why there is kind of talking of shortage, I believe. So that's why we better say this now, so the farmers prepare for future, so we can meet the demand in the future.
As for Alfred Kwai in Brisbane, his strategy is to pack up shop and shift his business to a new location, one accessible to more customers, and to make the most of the surge of Vanuatu kava coming into Australia.
And that was the ABC's Leola Wanbu with that story. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And join us again at the same time and same place next week for more news and stories from across the Pacific region.